There we go. First of all, thank you again for inviting me. I'm really impressed that this number of people are out on a Sunday night to discuss the parameters of possible modern orthodoxy in Israel is stunning. It's absolutely stunning and it's encouraging. So I thank you for inviting me. I'm going to try to organize what I've said, cut down what I prepared, to the point where we'll have time to discuss and to have questions. Because the truth of the matter is, I was looking when I started really getting down to preparing what I wanted to say tonight. It's easy, very easy, to get overwhelmed in terms of figuring out what to talk about. First of all, there's a massive literature about modern Orthodoxy. Modern Orthodox Jews have been agonizing about who they are and who they aren't and where we are and where we're not and all this other stuff for years. I mean, for decades, for at least 60, 70 years, maybe more. In fact, it's going, according to Zev Elif at HTC and Skokie, who put out this book, which I didn't even see how many pages this thing has. I mean, you can use it as a doorstop, I guess. 520 pages worth of short sources. So it's like, there's a lot what to say, and we only have an hour and a half. So what I wanted, and I recommend the book, by the way, and I don't get percentages or anything. What I thought I'd like to do is to try to highlight a couple of salient issues about modern Orthodoxy, especially as it should look or could look here in Israel, to try to define some of the terms and start an open discussion. I do want to make one distinction. The overwhelming majority of discussions about what goes on in the modern Orthodox community in America, and I'm going to argue for a minute that doesn't exist, that there's no modern Orthodox community here, is most of the people who write about it talk about what modern Orthodox Jews do, what they do, what they don't do, how often they go to shul, do they see R-rated movies, do they see, there's no such thing M anymore, but it used to be when I was younger, do they only see, PG, do they go to this, do they go to that? I mean, that's very nice, but that's looking at things from the outside. I'm going to assume for present purposes, that everybody in the room is more or less inside, or was inside when we lived on the other side of the pond, and I'd like to address what kind of issues from inside the community we should deal with, and sort of like aligning or creating the boundaries of our against which we interact. That's number one. Number two, I'm assuming that more or less everybody in the room grew up in everybody from the States or everybody from Europe?
Canada.
Okay, I know you're not supposed to say that, and so I'll talk about North America. But more or less, England's a whole other ballgame. England's a whole other ballgame. England kovat bracha la'atzma with a totally different dynamic.
American by marriage.
Okay. And we're all here. Now, what happens a lot of the time when Anglos, especially, come to Israel, they feel like something's missing. They feel like there's a texture of life that we're used to, that we grew up with, that isn't here. Sensitivities, there are things that make Israelis take for granted, and that Israelis, and that we don't take for granted. There are things that Israelis, that make them crazy, and we don't understand why it's an issue, and all kinds of things. So there's a difference in sensitivity. I'm going to argue in a minute that in the present cultural nexus that we have, that there are things that we can contribute. There are many things that Anglos can contribute to Israeli society, if only Israeli society would let us in, which is another issue, that we can really help to strengthen the Jewish identity of the country at a very critical time when we're in the odd situation in which, according to all of the best studies, the last one being the 2009 Gutman study from the Israel Democracy Institute, that is mapping... Something a lot of us have been aware of just intuitively that since the early mid 90s there has been an ever growing increasing sense of Jewish identity and deepening of Jewish identity, not Israeli identity, Jewish identity and Jewish traditional identity in all kinds of various forms within Israeli society, and somehow there's nobody home to communicate the Torah to the broader to the broader population. So I'm going to argue also that that's something which we can teach and we can bring to ourselves and also to to the Broad Arrow Israeli Society. Let me just tell you a little bit about me. I was born in Boston, Eretz Kodesh, again, I'm actually a fifth-generation Palestinian, a fourth-generation American, the same grandmother who was born in Salem, Massachusetts, and yes, I had an aunt who was a witch. I was also went to the Evelina de Rothschild Shula in Yerushalayim, which was known as Mrs. Landau's finishing school for young ladies at the time. I grew up in a very traditional home. I had the privilege of for 9.5 years learning with Rav Soloveitchik, because I lived in Boston, so he was accessible. And during the 6 years that I learned with him in Boston in a relatively small group, that was probably far more important for me than the 4 years I spent at YU, where I got smicha. But I've been involved in modern Orthodoxy, modern Orthodox thought and initiatives almost practically my entire life. In America, I was the founder and the executive chairman of something called the Orthodox Roundtable, which tried to bring modern Orthodox spin to halakhic issues, which we felt were going to be the cutting edge of Jewish life. Happily or unhappily, we were right all the way down the line. We started off with a discussion of adoption and conversion, then we went on to Betzitza Befeh, we talked about child abuse, we talked about all kinds of things, which ended up being at the top of the agenda like 10 years ahead. Yes, it's true, I was talking to Telling Bari, and of course it's true what Yogi Berra said, that the future is hard to tell, it's hard to predict the future is so uncertain, but sometimes you can get a sense of where things are going. So those are sort of my creds, and I've been doing all kinds of things here as well. I was on the board of Beit Hillel for 5 years. I'm on the board of Ma'aleh, the Merkaz Latino Tatit, and all kinds of other various things, which maybe we'll talk about. So that's what got me here. I am categorically and by definition not an ivory tower academic. I think if I were an ivory tower academic, I would wither and die. So that's the reason why I'm here. Okay, let's define our terms. Modern Orthodoxy in Israel. Israel, I think we all know that's where we're here. I want to say what modern Orthodoxy is for purposes of our discussion and what it's not. It isn't an excuse, right? Both in America and in Israel, there's a term for an individual who he's modern, but not because he's like axiologically modern or he's involved in the world or whatever. He wants an excuse to say, I'm not that religious. So in America, it used to be called a young Israel type, a person who closes his eyes and goes to a milk restaurant and eats fish, or a fleshic restaurant and eats fish and pretends not to see things and whatever. Similarly, here such a person is not called a young Israel type, because young Israel is generally very right wing and extreme here to the degree it exists. In Israel, it's called a Mizrachnik, which was the term that was given to sort of Hafif type religious people by the other side, which is who? The Haredim. That's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is something, I think, hopefully a little bit more sophisticated. And as a result, the term modern Orthodoxy really doesn't fit into the extant Israeli context. It never took root here. What we're used to, that of course you go to college, or of course when you go, of course as you go on you have a broader cultural outlook. That never took here. Religious Zionism is not by definition is not automatically modern Orthodoxy, because they just develop differently. The world of modern Orthodoxy, which ostensibly includes openness to general culture, advancing the standard, the status of women, an a priori commitment to the broader Jewish community globally, and so on, which were the basic elements that Dr. Lamb used to talk about, and I agree with him on this. He has the my imprimatur, but still. The cultural piece never fit in here. The cultural piece was never a center part of the take. What was here, what dominated religious Zionism, in Israel is what? Is the state, is Zionism, is the Geula, is the Mashiach, or whatever the case might be. And that's because, at the end of the day, from an intellectual point of view, there's one person, one and a half people, who rule the roost in terms of what we learn in school, or what the kids learn in school, and what's in the air, and that is Rav Kook. That's Rav Kook and Rav Kook and Rav Kook and Rav Kook. And Rav Kook, despite the fact that his intellectual you know, sort of outlook was extremely broad. He used to have a chavrusa with the Nazir of David HaKohen. The chavrusa was learning, you ready? Ulysses by James Joyce. They used to sit with Ulysses open and they would learn Rav Kook, and they would learn Joyce. And that doesn't go on in Merkaz HaRav. Okay? On the contrary, Merkaz HaRav is the center of the Chardali world where, yes, there's nationalism, yes, there's belief in the state and there's service and all the wonderful things that go with religious Zionism. However, a cultural agenda just isn't there. On the contrary, generally they tend to be anti, which also means that the graduates that come out of that world and serve in education or serve in the rabbinate are incapable of either parsing or engaging or helping or teaching anybody to engage in the world, which is flooding in on them, especially today in a world of the internet. It used to be that you could actually be somewhere compartmentalized. That doesn't hold anymore, which is one of the reasons why I think now, right this minute, is not only a time of challenge and crisis, it's also a time of opportunity for the types of things that we can contribute. So religious Zionism is not automatically modern orthodoxy. On the other hand, the religious Zionist community generally tends to be far more immersed in Jewish knowledge, more punctilious when it comes to observance, say, very, very prominent, just passed away, very prominent philanthropist from New York who supported institutions all over the world, once told me that I'm out of my mind. Well, he's not the first one to tell me that. But you're out of your mind. There's never going to be modern Orthodoxy in Israel. Why? Because they go to shul twice a day. So that, you know, so that's on the one hand. On the other hand, America, what we have to offer, I'll get to in a second, what we have to offer the Israelis is a sophistication which is lacking. Nothing I can do about that. Religious Zionism and modern Orthodoxy are not the same. We'll get to what modern Orthodoxy means in a minute. Modern is an even bigger issue. Because I literally could fill the room with essays and books trying to figure out what modernity means. It used to be thought, and that we have to figure out how postmodernism is, we throw these words around like nobody, like as if we all understood what they meant, but nobody does. Even the people who, I sometimes wonder whether the people who like talk about postmodernism, it's impossible to understand what they're talking about. It's actually impossible. And I wonder if that's because they don't understand, or they just want to sound smart. Could be one, could be the other. Reb Chaim Brisker used to say, "Asifelten hasbaris felten havana." If you don't understand, if you can't explain what you're saying, then you don't understand what you're talking about. That could be also. But the fact that postmodernism is a mess and is not really accessible and people don't understand what it means does give a sense of the fact that there is this sort of sense that we live in a crazy world, that everything that we assumed was true isn't. Or that it's relative, or that it's non-binding, or whatever the case might be. For our purposes, that doesn't really matter. Because the question I'm going to ask this evening is not what is the content of modernity, but how does anything interact with Judaism? How does anything interact with the Torah, and what models of interaction, you know, do we have at our disposal in what apparently is a crazy world? However, I did put the front page of a book by Marshall Berman, who was an English literature person and a very fine thinker. The book is called All That Is Solid Melts Into Air. It's probably the best introduction to modernity and postmodernity I've encountered. It's actually readable, and it's actually free. If you go on the web, apparently the copyright ran out, and somebody put up a PDF, and you can just download it. It's a very, very good book. His argument is that there really is no difference between modernity and postmodernity. The function of modernity is to let everything lead into total chaos. Everything just floats and becomes intellectual mush. That's the goal. Okay. Adkan, I bored you totally, or we can keep going. All right. The issue that we really have to look at is we automatically live in two worlds. We live in a world which is hopefully profoundly Jewish, and we live in a world which is very, very different than that. There was a time, perhaps, as I said before, that one might have been able to make a choice of either or to in fact measure, to what degree I want the outside world to come in, or to what degree, or not. We don't have that option anymore, because we're all in that, we're all addicted to the phone, we all listen to the radio, we all listen to the TV, and ideas and values, even in an uncritical fashion, that may be sustainable in a classical Jewish context, maybe not, sort of come rushing after over us and become absorbed by us, as I said, uncritically. We just sort of absorb it, and we don't look at ourselves in terms of asking ourselves whether these things are true or not, whether they're accessible or not. What I want to argue is that what modern orthodoxy demands is, and we'll see that in both models that we're going to talk about, what modern orthodoxy demands is a critical, not critical in the sense of being negative, but critical being careful, of being thoughtful. What do we want and what don't we want? What's acceptable? What's not acceptable? Is there room for standing up and rejecting things the outside world is offering us? Is there not room for that? Should we adapt the Torah to what the outside world says if we're convinced or so? Or should we live in a state of tension? Let's live in a state of doubt. Those are the kinds of questions that we have to ask ourselves. And that's the and that actually is the focus I'd like to place today. And what I need to do now is just to go to my second pair of glasses. So take the sheets. I'm going to forget about my notes. As Gabe knows, I do better when I don't speak from them. Okay. There are actually two ways, traditionally, that Judaism has interacted with the outside world. Actually, I shouldn't say that. There were three. Ashkenazi Jews, from day one, at least from the 8th century, have been constitutionally allergic to secular culture. That is why Sephardim and Eidot HaMizrach have always had much more positive encounters with the outside world than Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim have won up until the 19th century and the Enlightenment. The Ashkenazi position on the outside world was actually best expressed in an Italian Italian word, fe. That was the general attitude. There were here and there people who, you know, underneath the table would keep some secular books. But, I mean, I'll give you an example. The Ramah, Reb Moshe Isserles in the 16th century, mentions Aristotle in a responsum in order to define a certain biological reality that has to do with Hilchos Treifos. And his cousin, who was his cousin, Rabbi Shlomo Luria, the Marshal, who was a phenomenal Talmud Chacham, he was a... I don't want this recorded, but he was a religious extremist, put it that way. Screams and yells at him. How can you quote that Aristotle? He was uncircumcised. He was tummy. This and that. When you read the tshuva, the anger and the screaming come through the lines. It was never clear to me what bothered him more, that he was tummy or a rail, but Aristotle. And then the Ramah writes back, says, no, it's not true. I don't need to learn Aristotle. I sacha kol, I read the Rambam, and I don't even do it. I do it, you know, underneath the table when everybody else goes for a walk on Shabbos afternoon in Krakow, and they're all talking Lashon Hara, so that I don't have to talk Lashon Hara. So I read the Moreh Nevuchim, and that's where I learn my Aristotle. So please, you know, that's incredible. I mean, he gets all apologetic and defensive and whatever. That's a typical Ashkenazi. Ashkenazi position. So in that case, the truth of the matter is, from that point of view, the traditional Ashkenazi position is expressed by the Haredi world, which does in fact says no, 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 no. That's not the model I'm going to engage today, because I don't think it's right. I don't think it's good, and I don't think it's healthy, and I don't think it's possible. I don't think it's possible for the Haredi today either. One model is that which presented by traditional Jewish philosophers, and that was that. Basically, there really is no such thing as anything secular, really. There are secular ideas, there are non-Jewish ideas that are not compatible with Judaism, but at the end of the day, science, philosophy, things that are based on reason, are basically essentially Jewish. And they have always been Jewish, and the problem is that, you'll see, let's take a look. The Rambam in the beginning of the Moreh Nevuchim says, let's see, where are we? Okay, the last two words on the you know, so let's start with the second text. The Rambam in the first part of the Mordechai chapter 71 says da. By the way, in anything the Rambam says da, red flag. Hi, I'm going to tell you something really, really important. Da. Ki hachokhmot harabot asher hayu b'umateinu b'mitat elu ha'inyanim. He assumes that all of the philosophic and philosophical and scientific library that he inherited from the Greeks via the Romans, via the Christians, via the Arabs, and so on, was originally Jewish. In fact, there's a famous legend that Plato learned the Torah and learned philosophy from Moshe Rabbeinu. Now, that's somewhat problematic, because Moshe Rabbeinu died 800 years before Plato was born. But, all right, yeah, dream, whatever. But the point is, this idea that philosophy and the sciences were always part of the Torah. That Rambam doesn't say there was. He says those sciences which were part of our Torah and were part of our nation, b'mitat elu ha'inyanim, which confirmed the stuff he mentioned before, avdu ba'orach hazman, they got lost. Ubishlot ha'umot haschalot aleinu, we were ruled by foolish, uneducated, barbaric nations, and that did nothing for our intellectual health. Not only that, but there is a question of who should know what. The Rambam was something of an elitist, and the question is not everybody should know everything. Sometimes it better go where you don't, where you're not going to. If you're going to go where you don't understand, then maybe you're better off not studying it. But the point is that at least for the Rambam, that science and philosophy and so on were an integral part of Torah, and the logic is there. Because if God created man in his own image, and that image means his reason. Now, okay, I'm some skeptical about this whole question whether man has reason, considering what people do. In fact, one of the things that's even more bizarre to me is the fact that, what should we say, the Targum says that Adam l'nefesh chaya, that man became a living being, the ruach malmalala, to a spirit that could speak. And in fact, the power of speech is a synonym for reason in medieval philosophical literature. Considering what a lot of people say, I have my doubts, but that's what it says. In any case, the Rambam assumes they're all part of one, because if God created man in his image, and what's really in God's image is our reason, then therefore what we arrive at more or less by reason is true. If it's true, then it comes from God. The Torah clearly comes from God because it was revealed by God. If there is a disconnect between the two, it's because we don't understand how to resolve the tensions, and therefore most of medieval Jewish philosophy is devoted to a process of basically resolving contradictions and problems between the two sources of absolute truth. So the Rambam therefore puts philosophy as part of Talmud Torah. As far as he's concerned, they're coterminous. They're identical. The Rambam says it even more forcefully. The Rambam mentions this in Hilchos Talmud Torah. He says that one of the things you should spend your time learning is philosophy, alongside Gemara and so on and so forth, at least halacha. That, I'm going to leave open the question of the Rambam thought that the Mishnah Torah was going to sort of, you know, to replace the Gemara. But take a look at the first text here. The Rambam says it also quite baldly in just a few words. The Eina Kavanah B'Mamar Hazeh, he says, and my intention in this little essay is not to make things available to the mob or to everybody. V'lo l'madchilim b'iyun, and not to those who are just beginning taking, you know, what, philosophy 101. V'lo l'lamed mishlo yayen rak b'chokhmat Torah, and it's not intended for people who sit in kollel all day because they don't have the tools to deal with anything. Rotzeh lomar Talmuda. Ki inyan ha-ma'amar hazeh kulo, v'chol ma shehu mimenu, u'chokhmat ha-Torah alaymet. What I'm going to teach you is the deeper, more true knowledge of Torah. Gemara and so on is part of Torah, but this is a part as well and deserves equal, if not greater, greater emphasis. So the first assumption is that when you study what we would call secular studies, you're basically learning Torah. You could say a Birkas HaTorah on the Nicomachean Ethics, which were the basis of Maimonides' Shmona Prakim, for example. There are points of disconnect, and the Rambam finds all kinds of things among the Greeks that don't jive with what he sees as being the straightforward meaning of the Torah. But from an epistemological point of view, There really is no, there are two sides of the same coin, and that's it. There is something comforting and something dangerous, or extremely challenging, in that model. Number one, there's something comforting in the fact that I don't have to feel the pull between the two worlds. I don't have to feel myself split. On the other hand, the danger is that since philosophy is predicated on what each of us can achieve in terms of understanding, then the danger arises that we will think ourselves smarter than the Torah, in a narrow sense, by a half. And so the Rambam bends over backwards consistently through all of his halachic and philosophical writings, saying, no, you have to be humble. You have to know your limits. Ish kefi kocho. There's this sort of sense that if people are too empowered, they will think of themselves as gods, and therefore they will reject mitzvahs. They figure out that they know the reason why mitzvahs are given, and therefore reject them or say, oh no, that was then, this is now. And the Rambam is very emphatic in saying that by definition, the only prophet who has a right to have an opinion in matters of law is Moshe Rabbeinu. It's the reason why he turns the assertion of the absolute and unparalleled uniqueness of Moshe Rabbeinu as a prophet into a dogma. Part of it's an anti-Islamic thing, because by definition Muhammad couldn't give a new religion. But the deeper reason is the fact that by definition people can't be as great as Moshe Rabbeinu in terms of mitzvahs, in terms of law. The Rambam, in one place, for example, the introduction to the commentary in the Mishnah says that if you had 100 prophets saying the halacha is this way, and 100 run chachamim saying it's the other way, so we paskin like the 101 chachamim because Torah says acharei rabim latov. There is no room for prophecy, which the Rambam sees as a philosophical process in the context of the way that Judaism decides laws and decides matters of basic faith. So it cuts both ways. That's one model. A different model. And that was the one that was one more point I forgot to add. The third danger is that if you identify Torah with philosophy or the outside world or outside culture, however you want to look at it, the danger is that you will miss your bearings, and you will end up violating sort of the balance between the two. I want to read you a poem by Chernyakhovsky that I think sums this very nicely. In 1899, Chernyakhovsky was a pagan. Shaul Chernyakhovsky was a pagan. He was an avowed pagan. He liked being a pagan. His wife wasn't Jewish even. He was an interesting guy. He wrote a poem in 1899 called El Noch Lenochach Pesel Apollo. Anybody read it? Or am I the only old person still read Chernyakhovsky in high school? Okay, anyways.
Different generations.
What?
Chernyakhovsky.
Okay, beside her, there was still tzaddikim in the world. Okay, good. Chernyakhovsky has a long poem in which he loved the Greeks, he loved Apollo, he liked the gods, and the poem's about going into the museum and seeing this beautiful statue of Apollo and being heartbroken over the fact that the beauty of Greece no longer exists among the Jews, who are all into all kinds of other stuff. And it ends this way. Bati adecha mul pislecha ekoda, pislecha semel hama'or b'chayim. Ekod echra'a latov la'na'ala, la'sher hu nisa b'melo kol ha'olam, la'sher hu nehedar b'melo kol ha'briya, la'sher yesh meromam b'sod sodot ha'yitzira, echra'a l'chayim v'la'gvura v'la'yofi, which obviously Jews don't have, right? V'la'yofi, echra'a l'chol schiyot ha'chemda sh'shanedu pigrei anashim u'rekav ezera adam. Mordei ha'chayim, these are the Jews, mordei ha'chayim, they rebel against life, miyad suri shaddai. El Elohei Midbarot Hapeli, this God of a desert that we ended up following. El Elohei Kovshei Knaan Besofa, this God of storms who conquered Knaan. And they took Apollo, Vaya Asruhu Birtsu Otshel Tfilin. They took Papalo and bound him with tefillin. Now, all right, so I like this poem not because I like his message, but I like this poem because if you invert the image, it expresses the danger of saying that everything in the outside world can also be part of Torah. Because you may find yourself taking Apollo, the ultimate representative of Avodah Zarah, and everything the Torah objects, and throwing on a pair of tefillin on him and saying, oh, that's Jewish. So that's the danger in terms of that. Now, that assumes, by the way, as we get to the second model, that assumes something else, which I unabashedly and unapologetically. I do assume, with all the variations and all the change and everything else, I am an essentialist, a neo-essentialist, meaning that I think that there is a very clear essence of continuity of values and structure of values and ideals and beliefs that has accompanied Judaism from the beginning till today. There may be variations on themes, but the continuity is perhaps more overwhelming than the changes and the variations. And as a result, to just throw a pair of tefillin onto Apollo and say that's Jewish, I think it's distortive and I think it's dangerous. There is, in fact, the Jewish renewal movement in the United States, which happily hasn't come here. Eventually, it will come here. It comes here 5 years after it goes to the States. The Smurfs, remember the Smurfs? The Smurfs made it to Israel like 5-10 years after they had died, you know. And Papa Smurf became Dada Saba and so on and so forth. So we may yet see this. But the Jewish renewal movement in America is something like that. We should embrace worship of the ground. We should embrace worship of nature. We should embrace all that Abraham undid by rejecting idolatry. And that can be Jewish. It happens. So I'm not that totally out of my mind. Anyways, that's model number one. The model that I like, and the model that I believe in, and the one that's going to guide us mostly through the rest of the discussion. You can reject it if you want. This is my idea. You asked me to speak. That's what happens. Is that which was developed by Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal. And expressed by his two sons-in-law, Professor Tversky in the academic realm at Harvard, and by Rav Lichtenstein at the Gush, and by others like Walter Wurzberger. I think the most important living exponent of this kind of approach is Professor Shalom Carmi at NYU in all of his writings in various places. Part of the problem which faces American modern Orthodox Jewry is the fact that, and I think YU's original sin is the fact that while they developed great Talmidei Chachamim, they dropped the ball in the area of thought, in the area of philosophy, in the area of culture, in the area of anything that has anything out beyond Yeridea or the Chedal Shulchan Aruch, which I in no way, shape, and form wish to diminish. Ki huzeh. They're important, but when it comes to questions of faith and questions of values and questions of conflict, there ain't nobody home, and that's and YU and the rest of the community is paying a very stiff price for that. Anyway, I want to start with a letter that Rav Lichtenstein sent to the Jewish Daily Forward. There was a time Jewish Daily Forward was not the other side of Haaretz and Gidon Levy. I don't know if you saw today's paper. It was incredible. Gideon Levy said he has no sympathy for pregnant Nachlot who get shot because they deserved it. So that's and the Forward, I don't know if they're that bad, but they're certainly that bad. But there was a time the Forward was just mildly socialist and other people write to it. Anyway, in the 1990s, an organization was founded by my friend Rabbi Saul Berman called Eida, of which I was a part, and in whose conferences I participated. The idea was, it was a sense that modern Orthodoxy was sliding to the right, it was getting to be too Haredi. I'm not sure exactly what that meant. Some people objected to the fact that people were getting too punctiliously observant, that was a slide to the right, or that wearing black hat was too slide to the right, or there were all kinds of different, there was a lot of dissatisfaction, and there was a sense that modern Orthodoxy, however you define it, needs to be needs to be revived. A woman named Kessler, Sarah Kessler, wrote an article about the first ADOT conference. ADOT sort of disbanded a number of years later. And she mentioned that the unstated presence at the conference was Rav Soloveitchik. Because everybody there was either directly or indirectly a student of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik had died only 5-6 years before, and even though he had retired due to illness in 84 or 85, so it's been only 20 years or 15 years since he had actually no longer been active, there were people, he was still very much, his presence was very much tangible, and for the group that gathered there, he was the great legitimator. Because it's true, when it came to pushing for involvement in broader society and the belief in the positive role of general culture in invigorating and challenging and enriching Judaism without any kind of halachic compromise, because he was very small C conservative when it came to that, the Rav was the great legitimator. It's one and different people, of course, the Rav was said different things to different people because he wanted to be, you know, to tailor make his comments, and nobody really gathered the totality, which was very very, very complicated. The Rav was full of a lot of tensions. I can tell you myself, in March of 1976, I was simultaneously accepted to do my doctorate at Harvard and accepted writing the Smicha, and I didn't know what to do. So I went to go see the Rav, and it's one of these things where you just get in the car. It's like, Mahadil Elef Abdalos. But, you know, we can get in the car just like go to the hotel. So, Mahadil Elef Abdalos, you know, I was in Boston, I got in the car, drove like 20 minutes, sat with the Rav. So we sat and whatever and talked, and the Rav's position was basically something like, "Oh, I said I don't know if I can give up the acceptance to Harvard." That was the thing. So the Rav looked at me like I was crazy, and said, "Who told you to give it up?" So I said, "I don't know. What about learning?" So then he says, "What? You're not going to keep learning in our little group on Sunday mornings?" I mean, what? That was stupid. You know. What was I thinking? So anyways, but the point is that he, you know, said, go to graduate school and learn in an unofficial, in an informal setting, and that's fine. Okay? Anyway. And now I wasn't the only one to whom he said things like that. In any event, the way that this Mrs. Kessler wrote about the Ada conference prompted Rav Lichtenstein, who was already here, he was here already 25 years, to write a response. And he writes as follows: if modern orthodoxy and Ada as its presumptive plenipotentiary are to be, if you want to talk about writing high English, it's interesting, of the three sons-in-law of the Rav, of the Rav's two sons-in-law and his son, the only one who actually grew up in English was Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Lichtenstein, I think English was his third language. Yiddish came fourth. He learned Yiddish on the fly afterwards because his father didn't think he should know Yiddish. And for Satorsky was his second because he was raised in Yiddish. Anyway, so therefore there's a certain similarity between for Satorsky and Rav Lichtenstein's English because it's very, very. I used to assign articles by Satorsky to my students, and as part of the requirement to give things in English, and my wife would say, "You can't give that to them. It's not English." And there's a lot to that. Anyway, let's come back to Rav Lichtenstein. If modern orthodoxy and Ada, as its presumptive plenipotentiary, are to be defined purely as a quest for engagement with culture, in Matthew Arnold's sense, which means the best that has been thought and ever thought and said, then these claims can probably pass muster. The Rav favored engagement, cultural, social, and political, and rejected, as Milton, a fugitive and cloistered merchant, and acknowledge the energizing potential of secular studies as a source of richness, power, sensitivity, and depth. However, conventional wisdom assumes that these entities represent much social reality, and that Ada not only embraces philosophical... What? Oh, I did. However, conventional wisdom assumes that these entities represent much more than modernism. Thank you. Is not only an abstract conception, but a social reality, and that Ada not only embraces philosophic perspectives, but emblazons a manifesto and an agenda. With some of their salient details, the Rav's name certainly cannot be associated. I fully believe Rabbi Saul Berman and some of his colleagues when they assert that they drew inspiration for their work from the Rav's personality and teachings. However, the contention that his subjective favor lends credence to the converse claim that his imprimatur could be affixed to their positions is both fallacious and unfair. What does he mean? Okay. What? But by the way, these are words you can use at a cocktail party to impress your friends and whatever, and so on. What Rav Lipnitz is basically saying as follows. Rather than talking about the outside world and Judaism as two coterminous entities, intersecting entities which overlapping entities, you're talking about a world which has its own integrity, interacting with another world which has its own integrity. To the degree that the spiritual, intellectual, and cultural riches of the outside world can enrich, can stimulate, can challenge Judaism, then that's fine. To tether Judaism to modernity is a violation of the integrity of the Torah. That, he denies, and the Rav actually said on many occasions, we'll see in a minute, that absolutely is not to be accepted, because that is to enslave the Torah to a foreign system of values. Engagement, stimulation, yes. Identity and subjugation, absolutely not. Which requires, when we started, critical engagement with the outside world to see what passes and what doesn't. When you live simultaneously in both worlds, that can lead to fissure. That can lead to tension and can lead to discomfort. But out of discomfort and pain actually comes growth. This sort of model of two separate self-contained worlds interacting or responding to each other, I don't know what we do to the outside world, but let's talk about our world, lies behind another issue which is not related directly to modern Orthodoxy, but has to do with something that I've discovered over the years of doing Jewish intellectual history, not just history of halakha. There is a tendency, a sort of a very superficialist tendency, among Jewish historians and people who'd like to be Jewish historians, or people who'd like to get an agenda across, to say, oh, there's nothing to Judaism, we just take things from the outside world, and we just tack it on, and that's what there is. That everything is influence. Everything, this comes from here, this comes from there, as if there was nothing, we didn't do anything, we sort of walked in, and it's like, they don't have that anymore either. Used to be you went to a Chinese restaurant, and you had three columns, right? You could have column A, column B, you could mix and match, and so on and so forth. So that's what Judaism is. We got this from the Greeks, we got this from the Babylonians, we got this from the Judaism is nothing more than a pastiche of other things. First of all, there's no question that we are influenced by the outside world, but the process of influence, obviously we're influenced because there's not one room, not one person in this room, I have no idea how firm anybody is, but that's not the issue, okay? And there's not one person in this room who dresses the way that Moshe Rabbeinu dressed, the way that Yehuda Maccabi dressed, the way that, the Kohen Gadol dressed, or the way that Rashi dressed, for that matter, okay? Certainly not the way rabbis dressed in Spain in the Golden Age, or so-called Golden Age. It really wasn't, but that's another discussion. Or in Renaissance Italy. None of the guys here I see wear hose and are wearing those big balloon thingies instead of pants and funny shirt. Well, obviously, we're influenced. That's not the issue. The issue is, A, what penetrated and was adopted and what wasn't. Some things are not accepted. Number two, even those things which were adopted, to what degree were they adapted to fit our own pre-existent value system? And number three, and finally, what pre-existent need on our part predisposed us to be open to seeing what the outside world does? Because we have our own dynamic. And that insight is not something I came up with. It's not a YU rabbi sermon. This is a point that was made by Hamilton A.R. Gibbs, the great scholar of Islamic civilization, in an article on the way that Islam was affected by medieval Europe. So this is a permanent moment. So those who dismiss things as saying we just pick things along the way, sort of Mongol group religion, and not true. Yes.
One of the words I heard you use that I thought maybe you could address either now or in the continuation of the talk was you said Torah values. So I guess one question, especially as it relates to redefining modern Orthodox Israel now, is that a lot of people say, it's true, norms have changed, or maybe even this halakha, maybe is a little outdated, but it's Masorah at this point. I mean, so much time has elapsed, Jews for so many centuries have practiced this, So now it's become a Torah value. So I guess in that sense, you know, is a Torah value something that is sort of a priori that we follow, or is you know, at what point does Masorah trump even something that maybe isn't a Torah value, but it's sort of been co-opted as such?
Okay. For Masorah per se, the continued performance of things a certain way, it's definitely a value. Tradition by itself is binding. Tradition demands obedience. That doesn't mean tradition is static, but it grows organically. And there are certain, and there's a certain amount of room for give, and there are certain core things that that don't change. All right, you know, I had the list at the end of the thing, so I'm going to jump around. Let's take a look. All right, in our day, obviously the major cutting edge issue is feminism and gender issues. Okay, so let's talk about women's involvement in various things. Okay. Sometimes, on the one hand, there are certain areas where there's room for give, where there are all kinds of things which weren't relevant at the time, and where there's no objection except for sort of like conservative sensitivities not to change them. On the other hand, there are certain grund norms which are not going to change. There is no question, despite what is popular and what is considered to be dogmatic in the postmodern world, Judaism does subscribe to a sort of. It's interesting. It's an expression that was a friend of, that I heard at a meeting last week. I was at soft essentialism. That there is sort of a soft essentialist difference between men and women. There's a lot of variations and a lot of room for movement. But at the end of the day, the Torah assumes a binary. It's a gender binary. I don't get involved in the whole question of gender and sex, and just, they will never get out of there. So the question is how those play each other. Masorah is something which fashions the way that we look at things. Sometimes Masorah is a reflection of eternal value. Sometimes they're tangible. You have to take a look at the case by case issue. Over time, sometimes there is also value to what the religious community as a whole evolves in its attitude towards various things. There is a sense in the way some people interpret the Gemara and Pesachim, for example, that there is an inherent prophetic capacity there's a prophetic capacity that adheres to the body politic of the observant community, and that it moves at its own pace, and will move to change towards changes. Rav Moshe Lichtenstein in Makor Rishon yesterday said something which I think was really striking for me, considering the fact that he's a very conservative person. He said 200 years from now, if what we call now partnership minyanim are considered normative, he won't fall off his chair. But at the moment, the what the Karaites call Sevel HaYerusha, the burden of heritage, is binding, and we defer thereto. Otherwise, it becomes we go into anarchy. It becomes anarchic. I can't help it. We're not in a religion of Ishkol Yechshar Bein Av Yaseh. Yes.
Another question based on what you just said. I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's okay. We don't have to finish everything.
It's okay. You spoke about not tethering Torah values to other norms.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Rav Lichtenstein that said that you shouldn't do that, or that's not what the purpose of the Dachan or Rav Soloveitchik's talk was. How, I don't have this, I don't have one of the source sheets, but
you can have mine afterwards.
That's okay. No, oh, I see. But you said there was a list that you put some sort of list of topics at the end.
Yeah, what did I write? I wrote for our purposes.
Oh, so my topic isn't on. How would you then describe the work of Machon Somet and usage of electricity? It's not necessarily something that's anti-Torah values, but it's definitely not. Those aren't Torah values.
For that, I have a passage from Rav Soloveitchik in the next page. take a look. We're going to work through some of this anyway. In 1975, Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, remember who that is?
Sure.
Okay. Rabbi Emanuel Rachman, from the Bracha, was already anticipating, he was actually ahead of his time in that, said, we have to do something about Masorah Vot Get. Okay? So his suggestion at the time, he had a few suggestions. One of them was, there is a presumption, there's a chazakah in the Gemara that pops up a number of times, that says that women will settle. Women will settle, and therefore forcing a get on a woman is not always desirable, because a woman will always settle. She'd rather be married than be in this case. The Gemara says Tav makes of tandum and makes of armalu. Better to be married than live in tandem than to be widowed. That's not the opposite. The opposite is to be divorced. The opposite is to be single. Armalu, I saw, you know, it hit me after at one point that it reminds me of the threat that you tell the guy who doesn't want to give the get. So there are two ways for this woman to be free. One of them is to give a get, and the other one is the death of the husband. You choose. although there were people in New Jersey who went to jail for that, if I understand correctly. Anyways, not they didn't murder, but they threatened it. He said we have that with that assumption. That presumption is based on the status of women in antiquity, and now women are different, and the status of women is different, so therefore we should ignore it. So number one, on the one hand, that kind of behavioral presumption often is, in fact, socially determined. It's a priori socially determined. The Rav didn't like it, but that's for other reasons. Number two, what Rabbi Rachman didn't know, because he didn't do his homework, I'm sorry to say, is that as a student of mine wrote a 400-page doctorate on the subject of this chazaka, when was it used? That for the last, at least as far as the last 500 years are concerned, I mean, it's a limit to writing a letter, do because the thing was this big, I wouldn't be finished. That chazaka was never invoked by poskim to the detriment of women. It was either ignored, or it was used in order to be able to put pressure on the guy to make sure that the woman get a get. So he picked the wrong. He basically picked the wrong law. Anyways. The Rav, what Mashiach Pitzel Rav is effusing was the fact that Rabbi Rachman tethered a clear halacha in the Gemara to historicist reconstruction. In other words, what's historicism? Historicism is, I mean, like I'm a historian. So what do? I do the best I can to try to reconstruct what circumstances led to historical developments, halachic developments, and so on. I try to be humble in this. I never claim that I know what happened. No historian can ever know what happened because you don't have enough. You don't have data. You don't know what the guy was thinking. You don't know what the situation was. You have a few statements. Like people think that they can do it. Like archaeologists think, and I think it's the ultimate narrative. I can recreate an entire civilization based on a couple of shards of pottery because that's what they found. Okay, but that's a fluke. I do the best I can with the tools I have. But to sit there and say I'm going to peg the whole Torah to what I think today is the consensus, when in fact the consensus will flip over 100 times in the next 20 years, I've seen in my own, I'm a medievalist and a Renaissance historian. I have eons more material than people work in the ancient world. And I've seen the consensus on dozens of issues go 180 degrees flip because they found one more piece of paper. So that's... To say that historians and scholars know exactly what happened, therefore we can change what a text that we think to be divinely, the Torah being given or divinely inspired, is the height of irresponsibility. That's what made the Rav. Tripped the Rav's fuses. And as a result, he gave a famous tirade, polemic against Rabbi Rachman at a rabbinic alumni conference in 1975. So I'm not going to go through all of this. I gave you at the bottom a site of a transcription, and also you can hear it yourself. Happened in one of these cases where the Rav's drushes are clear. It's worth hearing his voice. It's worth hearing, and it's clear. You can understand. It's understandable. In the passages that I have here, I just want to make a... Well, I'll get to your point, but there's a reason I'm doing this. Number one, Torah is not a text for the Orthodox Jew. It's not a source. Yes, I know. In fact, a friend of mine just pointed out that if the major contribution of modern Orthodoxy to Torah study is the creation of source sheets. Apparently in the Haredi world they don't do this. We have computers. We have the Bar Ilan. We have Safaria. We have Ala Taran. We have the Bar Ilan Project Ashut. So we can create these nice little whatevers. So that's our big contribution. Anyways, Torah is not a text. Torah is the word of God, which means that your attitude. Look, what's a text? All right, I don't. My son Avi is here. He knows my weaknesses. A text is the Divine Comedy of Dante Alighieri. I love it. I have a little bust of Dante sitting on my desk. Okay, but that's a text. It's not Torah. Torah is a vehicle by which we encounter God. It's the veritable Word of God. Whether it's directly the Word of God as found in Tanakh, or whether it's something which is derived from the Word of God by people of responsibility, namely Chazal or Rishonim and Achronim, it doesn't matter. So for example, the Rav says, Talmud Torah is more than an intellectual performance. It is a total, all-encompassing, and all-embracing involvement, mind and heart, will and feeling, the center of the human personality, emotional man, logical man, voluntaristic man. Those of you who know the Rav's writings a little bit see this is typically the way he wrote. All of them are involved in the study of Torah. Talmud Torah is basically, for me, an ecstatic experience in which one meets God. If a Jew cannot experience revelation when he is busy studying, then he is also a Talmud Torah. So the question is starting with the fact that you are in encounter with the Word of God. So Masorah is a sort of like is a broader expansion of that broader mindset. It might be more flexible because it's what Jews who can subscribe to this idea of Torah do, and therefore that has religious charisma and authority. But from an experiential point of view, that's what it comes to. All you have to do is read tshuvot of rabbis through the generations when there was no prophecy, and how they agonize trying to figure out how they should paskin on any given question. Why? Because they're not just telling people what to do. This is not a matter of going to the lawyer, can I find this tax loophole? The responsibility that devolves upon the rabbi who paskins is a responsibility of spiritual life and death for himself, and all the more so for the person who asked. Because what he's asked, because if he makes a mistake, he is leading his, all right, unwittingly, he is leading his person, the person who asked him, into sin. Sin is a real category. Error is a real category. You stand in your kipper and you know, my contemporary society hates sin. Oh, it's a therapeutic issue. It's a wonderful. I recommend his books. He Dafka couldn't write, but I strongly recommend the writings of a sociologist and historian of ideas named Philip Reif, who was actually married to Susan Sontag, which is really bizarre because he was very, very conservative and Susan Sontag was not very conservative. Anyways, he has two books. One is called The Triumph of the Therapeutic. And the other one is called My Life Among the Death Works, which I strongly recommend. But basically what Reif says is that a contemporary society doesn't want to accept personal responsibility or punishment or anything because everything's therapeutic, everything's either Marxist function of material circumstances or it's because something was wrong with me, but I can't have personal responsibility. I can't be responsible if I'm an emotional issue. So that actually basically dissolves the entire Torah system of personal responsibility. So the Rav and but that's not what comes out of reading Tshuvot. I don't want to lead this person to sin. Now that doesn't mean if a person really has emotional issues that's not a mitigating factor and you shouldn't consider it. But globally, no, because this is the Word of God, and we have outside responsibilities on us demanding that we give up part of our autonomy, which is the other sacred value of our society. It's one of the reasons why we're at such loggerheads with it. I feel so uncomfortable. What? Some God is going to tell me when I should get up and when I should sit down and when this and that. And I want to do that. We worship ourselves. It's a narcissistic. Well, you want me to throw it out? I'll throw it out. One of the books that I made all of my kids read was by a woman whose name is Edith Hamilton. I won't say Margaret Hamilton, but Margaret Hamilton. Everybody knows who Margaret Hamilton was?
No.
Margaret Hamilton was the, well, the Wicked Witch of the West, in the original make of The Wizard of Oz, and later on, nobody's going to remember, we might remember, was the Maxwell House lady, Cora. Anyways, but this woman, Edith Hamilton, wrote a book called Mythology. And Mythology is probably the best summary of all the great myths of the Greek and Roman world, and I made all my kids read it. At the beginning of that book, she said something which I walk around with all the time. She says, as opposed to the Egyptians, the Greeks made the gods in their own image. Roll that around your head a little bit. Too much autonomy means that we worship ourselves. And we worship people. We worship celebs. People who, you know, there's a great book called Shut Up and Sing. The entertainers who never had an original title. Okay. This is usually where I work. When it, this kind of discussion is usually like where I ask what's a Kardashian, but unfortunately I found out. But the Torah is binding because we believe that God commanded us, and therefore we gave up part of our freedom in order to have the freedom of serving Him. That's the business of chavrut aluchot v'chavrut aluchot. So the Rav goes on along those lines. I'm just going to talks about the fact Talmud Torah is an act of surrender. And Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim means just that. That we accept the yoke of heaven to be free. Interestingly, one of the along those lines, there was a wonderful. I mean, if you're not familiar with his writings, you should be. One of the great Israeli philosophers, who is not religious. His name is Eliezer Shvayt. He lives not far from here. Lives in Abu Tor, and he wrote a book about the Moedim. And in it, he says Shabbos is the ultimate expression of this idea, because people that are not Shomer Shabbat become enslaved to their jobs. People that accept the Shomer Shabbat, they accept the limitations that the Torah puts on us in terms of our behavior, but it liberates us from, and this was before, he wrote these things before there was, you know, phones and stuff like that. All right? I don't know if there were phones, but they were cell phones. So he says, in number four, for example, he talks about we get to the point. What does Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shamayim require of the Lomed HaTorah, the person who studies Torah? One must join the ranks of the Chachmei HaMasorah, Chazal, Rishonim, Gedolei Achronim. I always got a kick out of the fact that he says Rishonim, he doesn't say Achronim generally, because there are some that are okay and some are not. And one must not try to rationalize from without the Chukei HaTorah, and must not judge the Chukim u'Mishpatim in terms of a secular system of things. Such an attempt, be it historicism, be it psychologism, be it utilitarianism, undermines the very foundations of Torah u'Masorah, and it eventually leads to the most tragic consequences of assimilationism and nihilism, no matter how good the original intentions. Because the minute that you eviscerate the Torah and say, oh, it's only that, there's no reason to keep it. Except sentiment. And sentiment, the minute the sentiment is not convenient, goes. Second, we must not yield. I mean emotionally, it is very important. We must not feel inferior, experience and develop an inferiority complex, and because of that complex, yield to the charm, usually it is a transient and passing charm, of modern political and ideological sfarot. There is no need for apology. We should have pride in our Masorah, in our heritage. That's the broader meaning of Masorah. Masorah is not excuses. No, you can't do that because it's Masorah. Because sometimes the Masorah is not that important. You have to take it point by point issue, for example. Friday night we had guests, and there was me. Oh, there were two guys and three women. So our minig in our house, not our minig, so then, is that if there's a mezuzah, if there were three women and there aren't three men, the women are mezuzah, and the men answer. Period. And more than once, I mean, because that's a din. I mean, the truth of the matter is, I think Tosus is right. That in fact, there's a chiyuv on the part of the women to be mezamen, and they should be mezamen. And Rav Shlomo Mezamen, who was not the modern Orthodox rabbi, he did not go to YCT. He said absolutely the men should answer. It used to be that they said no, the women should go out, and maybe not. Nah, baloney. That's the din. The Masorah was not to do it, so the Masorah was not to keep the halacha. The halacha is the women should do it. Ain't for chokhmah, ma. Similarly, I'll give you another example. That's actually a straight thing. Another case where we have sort of soft masora, absence of evidence, not evidence of absence. So the custom, this Danny Sperber mentions in the first volume of Minhagei Yisrael, that the poskim in the 17th, 18th century have a long discussion. When you have a bris, who drinks the kosher bracha? Who drinks it? So give it to the Milan. So he dug in and he found out, no, the minhag was for many, many years, until the 13th century, that the mother got the wine. And the truth of the matter is a good reason, because if anything is traumatic, I don't know how many of you are married and have a son, that's very traumatic to have they usually don't want to be there. Anyways, what happened in the 13th century? 13th century, for whatever reason, and I haven't figured that out either, women stopped going to Brit Mila. It might be related to the fact that they used to have the bris and shul, and at the time, anybody who was tameh, men or women, did not go into the shul in Ashkenaz. I think that's actually the reason. Women had tumat leida, and so she wouldn't go to the shul. The shul was considered to be beit hamikdash, but not beit hamikdash like this, but mikdash mat like 99% and 44% 100% beit hamikdash. So tameim did not go to the and that's the background of the whole minhag of nidot not going to shul. It's got nothing to do with discrimination against nidot, because guys who need to go to mikveh for being balikari were not allowed to daven for the yomim until they went to mikveh. Kohanim would not duchen until they went to mikveh, which is the reason why in Chutz La'aretz Kohanim only duchen on chagim, because they would go to mikveh erev chag, because going to shul is aliyah l'regel to the Beit HaMikdash. And all right, they went to mikveh already, so they duchen. The din is you're supposed to duchen every single day of the year, despite what? Why didn't the Kohanim go every day? Because it's cold. Either women went. Women are moist in there. Anyway, not important. All right. In any case, actually, a friend of mine, Professor Simcha Emanuel, recently demonstrated that that's not so true either. That until they figured out a ways to heat the mikvahs, that women weren't going to mikvah either. They weren't having relations all through the late fall to the early spring. He has all kinds of indications. Of course, if we had Mila books, then we'd know, because that would mean that we'd be able to tell when the births were. Right, mm-hmm. I can count. I mean, I'm innumerate, but I can count to nine. In any event, let's come back to this. So there's a case where people didn't do it, and so the question was: so who do you give the wife the cup to now? So they didn't give the cup to the woman. Now the mother comes to the shul. So give the cup to the mother. You can revive the old medic. We didn't used to do it. Okay, so we used to do it. Same thing with chaylit. There's all kinds of things like that. Again, you have to take this on a point by point basis. In any event, finally, so the Rav said, to tether the Torah to something else, especially if it's speculative, especially if it's a system, whether it's psychology, whether it's historic, with the contemporary consensus on something in history, and then to overturn what we think in advance, what we believe in advance is the Word of God or derived from the Word of God, that's deeply problematic.
No, it just is influences.
So finally it comes, all right, so good. So take a look. So thank you. Number six. And to speak about halacha as a fossil, Rachmana Litzlan, is ridiculous. Because we know those who study halacha know it's a living, dynamic discipline which was given to man in order to redeem him and to save him. We are opposed to shinuyim, which means externally imposed changes. But chiddush is certainly the very essence of halacha. There are no shinuyim in halacha, but there are great chidushim. But the chidushim are within the system, not from the outside. That is, so we have to maintain the integrity. So electricity, Beseder, what do? You take a look and see what this thing is and how it jives with what we know. And by the way, the question of the status of electricity is an ongoing issue. I mean, initially, the poskim were very makil. And then the Rav actually led the charge to say, no, electricity is fire. I mean, he had a right to an opinion. He studied with Max Planck when he was in Germany, with great Nobel Prize physicist. But now there are people who say, no, it depends on whether it's lights or whether it's whatever. LEDs and stuff are raising all kinds of issues. If you're familiar with, there's a major machlokas between Reb Nachum Rabinovich and Reb Usher Weiss on the question of the status of electricity, especially on Yom Tov. So, but that's by evaluating it based on our system. In other words, having outside. So when we talk about Taru Mada, Mada is less of an issue. I never understood why these people say science is. Even evolution. It's not, unless you're a Christian fundamentalist, evolution is not such a challenge. I mean, if you know the story of Rabbi Nathan, actually my former student, Rabbi Nathan Slifkin, and the zoo rabbi in Beit Shemesh, was put into Cherem because he said stuff which lines up with all kinds of Rishonim that say that, you know, science is not the big bugaboo. It's the challenge of self-centered humanism and culture which is the issue. I don't see science as the major issue. Okay, so that's as far as that's concerned. In any event, so my point. But what we went through here in terms of what the Rav says is, I think the model you see is pretty clear that the that Judaism has its own integrity. There are areas where there are variables. There are areas where there is a lot of stretch. But at the end of the day, the Jewish people as a collective, and that's where Masorah really comes in, as a collective accepted certain texts as binding. I know it's a word text, excuse me. Certain books as binding. And we live within the parameters of those books. Klal Yisrael, however it happened, there were three or four different theories among the Rishonim, accepted the Bavli. Rejected the Rishonim, accepted the Bavli. We accept the Shulchan Aruch as an ever-growing canon of law. We defer to people whose piety, and piety is important here, piety and recent events in our community have emphasized how piety and personal deportment are more important than knowledge. In fact, it's interesting, there's a Gemara in Ma'id Katan that talks about a person whose behavior was nefarious, but he was a big Talmud Chacham. So the question is whether we can keep learning, should we put, the question over there was, it's Tetzayan Amin Aleph in Ma'id Katan, the question is whether you should put him in Cherem or not. What was the question? The question was, on the one hand, he's a walking, talking Chilul Hashem. On the other hand, he was a big Talmud Chacham, and we could learn a lot from him. And the Gemara comes down very strongly on this end of don't read the books, don't use them, just put them in Cherem. There are some people who just outlive their welcome. So we defer to that. And there are people, and that's the other issue, by the way, another point of disconnect. We live in a society which rejects authority. And even without believing in Da'at Torah, which I don't, and neither Rav Lichtenstein, neither is the Rav, at least maybe at one stage, but not certainly not later, not in the sense of an oracular prophetic capacity. We subscribe to a higher authority. We defer to a higher authority. That's how it works, because we are out there Hashem. The payoff is to be out there Hashem. And in fact, I don't want to keep you here all night. One of the differences, I think, between American Jewry and American Orthodox Jewry, American modern Orthodox Jewry, and Israeli Orthodox Jewry and religious Zionist community and its various parts is in fact the question of God. I have long been horrified at the realization that one's personal relationship with God is not on the agenda of the day schools, of the yeshivas, of rabbis and shul. I spoke in Tinek Yir HaKadosh, again, Aleh Elokim, a number of years ago, and I spoke about this, and the rabbi, I won't say which shul, there are a lot of shuls there, rabbi comes up to me and says, you know, I spoke about God a few weeks ago. A few weeks ago? Let me throw a statistic at you. According to the IDI Gutman study, fully over 86% of all the Jews in the state of Israel believe in God, and believe in a God who knows what they do, and who wants them to do well, and will punish them if they will reward them if they do bad, if they do the right thing, and so on. And a personal God to whom you can turn, Beit Sara or Beit Simcha. In America, American Jews, generally, the number of Jews who think that or believe that way, something below 24%. More strikingly, 99% of Haredim in America believe that, but only 86% of the modern Orthodox believe that. Now, that 14% is problematic. And when they when asked who's the God you believe in, it's a lot. It's very attenuated, kind of not. He's sort of there, but it's not an imminent reality. Here, God gets mentioned all the time. That's a different nuance. It's a different part of the texture of society. Yeah.
Okay, but if I were to go back to the beginning of your speech, you said that American Jewry has what to teach Israeli Jewry.
So good. So that's the next step. Thank you very much for keeping me on track. At least I. So that being the case, I'll skip the other things I was going to talk about. We here grew up knowing or thinking that we have nothing to fear from the outside world. The model, this is the way the Rav taught, was that because we start assuming a priori the integrity of the Torah, so we can creatively and critically and judiciously engage the outside world without surrendering thereto. Now that has two very significant implications. Implication number one is for us, in terms of enriching our own inner lives, in terms of expanding our cultural horizons, even as it ostensibly should enrich our religious lives, and for us to develop the kind of tools to be able to, as I said, critical engagement, of knowing what we can let in and what we can't. The other side of that, and that's the text from the Rambam that I have here, is the fact that we learn a new language. By engaging the outside world, we learn to have a language wherein we can take the language of the outside world and not only engage the outside world, but also explain the Torah in words and concepts that the outside world can, in fact, understand. It's part and parcel of the same kind of dialogue. You have to know what the outside world, how the outside world speaks to engage it, but you also can communicate that way. That is something that is absolutely lacking in the state of Israel today. Part of the dialogue of the deaf that goes on between the non-Orthodox population and the Orthodox world is the fact that, especially in the media, and I spend too much time in the media, but I've been involved in radio and television enough and with journalists to know that people who come to represent Torah in the media, generally speaking, do not know how to make the case for Torah in terms, to use, to quote Jefferson, they could command the respect, never mind the assent, of the other person. And that leads to a terrible Chilul Hashem. Because the Torah can be presented in a way that the average intelligent person can understand, we need to have those tools. And those tools are a result of the fact that you engage the outside world. Most rabbis who appear on never mind the Eretz Yakodesh. Everybody knows what Eretz Yakodesh are? Those are like the Haredi radio stations. But even on Radio Moreshet are incapable. I don't mean to be nasty. They just never had the tools. They never were exposed to be able to explain Torah, present Torah in a way that is sophisticated and command the respect of the other person. And maybe even know better. I'll give you an example. There was a time before anybody here was born, except for me. No, Avi was born, and we were born, and a few of us were born. That Channel 2 television was experimental. We didn't have Reshet and Keshet and Meshet and Pleshet and none of those. It was experimental. And I remember I was sitting, I'll never forget, I was ironing shirts. Yeah, I was ironing shirts. I had just actually gotten, they just brought spray starch to Israel, which is a big thing. Because in America, I used to bring my shirts to the Chinese laundry, and now I get that same sort of stiff shirt kind of thing. So I'm ironing and watching TV. So on the TV an encounter between some distinguished rabbi and a professor from Tel Aviv. And the rabbi said a few things, which were nice, they were sweet, whatever. Then the professor said, well, if you knew anything about humanism, if you knew anything about Pico della Mirandola and his essay on the dignity of man, you know that man is everything and that God is not that important, and on and on and on. And I'm sitting there chaloshing, because number one, Pico della Mirandola was a profoundly religious Catholic. He, in fact, learned Kabbalah from two Jews, Yochanan Alemano and Elia Bacher, because he wanted to delve more deeply into his spirituality. He thought that he thought you could square the Trinity with the Eitz Chaim, with the Esther Sfirot. So number one, the guy is misrepresenting Pika. Second of all, I said, wouldn't it have been great if this rabbi could turn around and say to him, "Did you read? That's interesting. Did you read it in Italian or in Latin? Because there are differences between the two. And if you really read it, you would know that the terms in which, and it's true, that Pico uses in the Dignity of Duration, the Dignity of Man, are perfectly squared with the first two Prakim Embracious upon which it is based." So that's a polemical context. But if you take out the polemic for a minute, think of the Kiddush Hashem. Now, we can't all be Rav Soloveitchik. I don't think anybody can. But in our own way, we have the terms to be able to explain the Torah to other people in terms that they can respect. In fact, I once saw Dr. Lamb that I thought every Jew should be a Jesuit. He thought it was crazy. But the point, what did the Jesuits do? The Jesuits, fighting back against the Protestants in the Reformation, basically learned how to present Catholic dogma to intelligent individuals who read, because at that point the printing press was basically responsible for the Reformation. And take back territory to present their religion in ways that was accessible. So we not right now have a situation, and that's basically what breaks my heart, but it's an opportunity, where for the last 20 years there has been a resurgence in Judaism in the country. It scares the hell out of certain radical elements, and that's where the anti-Hadatah thing comes from, because they realize that at the end of the day, the country is getting more and more and more and more Jewish. Not necessarily frum, but certainly profoundly Jewish. There is more Torah study for non-Orthodox Jews going on in this country than ever before. It's not taking place in universities. That might be good, might be bad, I don't know. But informal groups, Torah study groups, in kibbutzim, there are the mechinot achiloniot. Do you realize what that is? That is chiloni kids who are going for a year to study what it means to be a Jew and encountering Torah. It also been encountering for poetry and all kinds of other stuff. Good. The thirst is incredible. What's the problem? The problem is, with all the thirst, there's very few people at home to bridge this, to bridge it and to bring Torah in a respectable and respectful way to others, because there's a lack of language. That's one of the things we can provide. And also a certain type of sensitivity. Since we lived, and that's why I mentioned the conversion thing, which is really a topic by itself. One of the most important things that we have going for it, you know what, I'll tell you a story. A woman from Ale Dumim posted a story on Facebook that went viral today. That there was a group of chayalim that were going through the shuk last week, and the men went over to the falafel. I don't remember the falafel guy. I think it's the guy mamish on the corner of not the hippie who sells the honey. It's a couple of doors down. He's been there forever, by the way. I remember when we had dark hair and he was selling honey. And when I first came to Israel in 1971. But anyway, he's been there forever. Anyways, the mem goes up to the falafel guy. Says, "I need 28 falafels." He says, "Okay, make 28 falafels." Then he comes to pay him. He says, "I'm not. I'm not taking money. It's a chayalim. That's it." We have here something which is incredibly precious, and that is a fundamental. And I use this word in all the respect. Tribal, implicit, intuitive connection with each other, irrespective of our differences, which takes it about 95% of the population, maybe 90% of the population. Part of that is predicated upon the fact that at the end of the day, everybody in this country can more or less marry everybody else. That basic. And we live on a spectrum of being Jewish. The fact that we have a significant population now which is halachically not Jewish endangers that. So I think it's actually a security issue as well. The Rabbanut, because it isn't, it's not just because it was a Haredi takeover, because of the fact that the Rabbanut here, or the rabbis here, have never encountered a situation wherein our community has to interact with a significant, non-hostile, non-Jewish population. I said non-hostile because Arabs there are. I mean, you know, Seder. But in terms of people who are essentially part of our community, we do. We grew up in that reality. Our rabbis grew up in that reality. And it's a sensitivity to what that means and what that can achieve, what Hilchot Giyur can be allowed to do, not based on changing halacha chalila, but what parameters the Torah allows for based on our experience is something which is another contribution, which our sensitivity to a broader outlook can bring about to actually save, I think, this biyachad, which is so critical to our country. So if I want to sum up, modern orthodoxy is necessary for us ourselves, and we have to provide it, if we don't get it from the schools or from society, to develop to take the sensitivities that we have from America or from Canada. Famous story about Rabbi Elazar Silver, who was the head of the Agudas HaRabbanim, and he held himself to be the chief rabbi of the world. So he was once stopped by a cop because his driver was speeding, and the cop wanted to give him a ticket. So the driver says, "Do you know why I have a car? I am the chief rabbi of the United States." Then the window comes down, and Rabbi Silver says, "In Canada." In any event, we need this for ourselves, but more importantly, we needed to be able to show the broader society how to engage critically by maintaining our own integrity, and also to reach out to the rest of the world. The means it's a responsibility on our rabbis that we choose, on the institutions that we support, and on ourselves too, because at the end of the day, those of us who work in the broader society find ourselves in consistently being the rabbi. Because a lot of chilonim don't know anybody. So if you're the kippah or you're the datia who's working in this, you're going to ask questions. My daughter, my youngest daughter, is a tatzpitanit in Chatmar Etzion, and she is in a group. She's in a unit where she is the only religious woman. And every 5 minutes, it's another WhatsApp because they want to know. People want to know. It's our responsibility to be the Jesuits, not to missionize in the bad sense, but to be a source of education. But to explain in a way that's respectful and whatever. Now, we didn't get to the hard issues, like really the core issues of gender and LGBT and all this other stuff, which is not really deserves another separate discussion. But at the end of the day, our commitment to Torah and the fact that we're out in the world in Tov Shekach can not only be salvation for us, I think can also be one of the most important contributions we can make to the to Israel per se, as we sort of grope our way to being a much more profoundly Jewish country than anybody would have thought 25, 30 years ago. So thank you.
It is late, but if anyone has questions, discussions, it's always people I think should feel free to, if they have a comment of their own, to reply to somebody else's question, you know what I mean? So if anybody has anything you want to add, now's the time.
Yes.
Just on the last point you made, that us being in the society is one way to contribute and do the best things. While it can be, it's also one of the greatest dangers.
Yes, that's true.
Can you address that? And
look, going outside in the outside world is dangerous. There's no question. And you have to know. Yeah, one of the things that we don't cultivate, and our society doesn't cultivate, is humility. And that is no, really. So you have to know what you can't do also. And going someplace where you're going to be where you're going to involve yourself in real issues might not be the smartest way to go. The Rambam's argument that we should learn to live with our inadequacies, our limitations, and rely on God at some stage. From doubt, doubt is a legitimate religious category, but you have to learn to live with it. You know what? It might have been. I said this before, but I want to emphasize it again. It might have been possible at one stage to isolate yourself from the world and to live a pristine, I think you'd call it tamimistic kind of religious lifestyle. It may very well be that was the better way to go. Once the outside world can't be kept out, you don't have an option. You have to struggle. You have to struggle and live with doubt and live with issues and bolster your faith. I know it's very hard to do, but we are bidden to sacrifice, and we're bidden to make that effort. We live in a society which hates discomfort, and yet the Torah demands that we live outside of our comfort zone. Spiritual and religious sloth is the antithesis of what the Torah demands. And the pay, you know, and look, I went back to the gym. I never went to the gym. 5 years ago, I started going to the gym. And, you know, and even so, you know, so we're up to whatever I'm pumping. No pain, no gain. It's that simple. And a supportive community and other people who also struggle and who also try to deal is a way of doing this. I mean, for example, I'm part of I just joined a group. It's called Machon Yedaya. Machon Yedaya has a website called Lada'at Laha'amin, in which very, very talented thinkers, the combination of rabbis and academics and young educators, all kinds of people, write essays on issues that people are really concerned about, and to give them food for thought, how to strengthen their faith when in fact the very idea of faith is called into question. I brought actually a book by a colleague and friend of mine who has a PhD in philosophy, and the book is the guy's name is Moshe Rat. The book is called Pashut Lahamin, and he goes deep into the question of, well, what about, you know, is it really crazy to believe? Is it reasonable? It's things to think about. We're not doing this alone. That's why Jews do things that we're not monks. We don't go live in caves. I mean, if we look at Ma'alei Edomim, the only actually significant archaeological find is this thing called the Heraclium. It's one big dining room. Byzantine Greek Orthodox monks used to live in caves. So once a year they come for dinner. So they all get together and have one dinner. I don't know if they talk to them. But in any case, we don't live that isolated. We live as a community, and everybody's supposed to help everybody else get through that kind of crisis. But we need also to cultivate and to find the people that can help and to develop the kind of leadership that can do that. I mean, I'm not saying that that's our job as individuals, but as a group, there's no question. And as a group, if we can stand against positions that the Torah cannot endorse, we can't just take psukim out of the Torah and chuck them because they don't fit the present zeitgeist. That is very uncomfortable. It is nevertheless the hallmark of Judaism. The Rav used to love the Medrash of the Bereishis Rabba. Lama nikra Avraham Ha'Ivri? Ki kol ha'olam me'Avra zeh v'hu me'Avra zeh. That's what we're about. It's very uncomfortable. Think about, I mean, we don't realize, they must have thought he was insane. Everybody knows that there are gods. It's crazy to think otherwise. Do you know what the charge, you know what Jews were charged with more than anything else in the Greco-Roman world? Actually, two charges. One was sloth, because they don't work 7 days a week. The other one was atheism. Why? Because they don't believe in the gods. Atheism didn't mean no God. It meant no gods. So we were absolutely nefarious for doing that. But we have to do it together. Isolated? No question. How did Lucy put it? Charlie Brown. See these five fingers. Individually, they can't do anything. But if you bring them all together, Lucy said, I can punch it. All right, so we don't have to punch anybody. But the fingers together create something. Everything, it's not for nothing, everything by us is community. Because we support each other. And we support each other in our doubts as well. And we have to be open and honest about it. That's not just therapeutic, that's just the Torah. Any other questions? Yes?
We've got a question a little bit further. Going back to your original distinction between like the different understandings of what modern orthodoxy means. I mean, like, is it orthodoxy that's tethered to the modern world, or whether it's taking, you know, aspects of it? So how do you sort of like set? How do we set the agenda and like differentiate between where we draw the line? Tend to think of it in terms of like Chol HaMoed, right? Like most of us think of Chol HaMoed supposed to be a holiday that has allowance that you're allowed to do. We think of it as it's a whole day, but there's a couple of things you have to have, you know, longer davening. So how do we sort of...
Okay, well, you know, it's funny you should mention that. First of all, if you take it as a point-by-point, you take it on a point-by-point basis. I think that's if it's an issue by issue thing. There's no rule because the rules will change depending on what the Torah says on specific issues. There are all kinds of different variables. It's not I can't cross the board. It's hard to say. However, it's funny you should mention Chol HaMoed because if any place when there's Chol HaMoed, it's here. I never felt Chol HaMoed in America ever. Chol HaMoed, I'm not kidding. But Chol HaMoed in America was a day that you went to shul in the morning. It was a long davening. You got to work late. Or I was a rabbi and I was academic, so I don't work. But
the whole country sucks then.
Right. That's exactly the point. It's really Chol HaMoed. I mean, so here the question really comes down to, in terms of Chol HaMoed, is to what degree am I going to be machmir in things like writing and stuff like that? But largely writ. You know, a lot of things that people almost intuitively hear. I have a Facebook feed that goes from people that are like teenagers to like there's one guy just turned 92 or something. But there's this like clump of friends of mine who as Chol HaMoed goes on see the pile of laundry they get higher and higher, and it kills them because I might have a nice Chol HaMoed, but mostly I'm just gonna be awful. That's a very, sometimes the line can be individual, but it has to be by point by point. I mean, you know, so for example, again, are you going to go to opera? So a friend of mine told me he was going to the opera today to instead of coming here today. It was fine. But, you know.
And I mean, it's meant more in terms of like setting an agenda for like, you know, schools and or communities, like where, what are we encouraging versus what's...
That requires, again, that's a point-by-point thing, because that becomes a question not of of a strict halacha, but of religious policy. Religious policy, by the way, is a halacha. What do I mean? I mean, that if a person sets a curriculum for a school, you have a general idea about the gestalt where you want to go. So sometimes you will prohibit, you won't do things which might be mutter, but they might impugn your broader sensitivities. Sometimes the atmosphere within which you live is not necessarily given to just a question. It's not always a question of straight halacha. It's a question of sensitivity. It's a question of how do I put it? I know whether it's a pasnish, it's okay. In other words, there are some things you don't do because you want a certain atmosphere in life. The halacha is a framework, but agadita and hashkafa fill that framework with other things, and sometimes they actually transcend. This way, how many people have ever gone out and sawed and built a house on Shabbos? No, we don't. I mean, if you think about it, if you learn about Shabbos, the number of melachas that are relevant to your Shabbos is minuscule. Most of Masechta Shabbos absolutely does not come up. All right, the closest thing, it's also to Shecht, okay? You have Daf Yomi doing Chum. It's also to Shecht. Okay, nobody ever in their right mind ever thought about shechting on Yom Tov. The closest you come is going to kill the fly that's making you crazy. All right, but most of Shabbos has got everything to do with subjective mitzvot say or subjective things which are not even mitzvot, and very little to do with straight halacha. So you've got to balance every single case very, very carefully, and ask yourself not only what's mutter and what's sasser, but what values and what state of spiritual awareness do I wanna cultivate? And that's what you decide. It may be perfectly mutter, okay, to listen to Andrea Bocelli sing Adesta Fidelis. In fact, Barbara Streisand, so you ever know who Andrea Bocelli is? He's like the world's greatest tenor. Barbara Streisand said if God sang, that's probably how he sang. I don't know if I would teach Adesta Fidelis in class. It's probably what it's are, but right. There are other things to do. I mean, you understand there are broader issues. Here I would actually very strongly recommend a book by a complicated guy himself, a guy named Peter Berger, who recently passed away, one of the greatest sociologists of religion. He was born a Jew in Vienna. He was converted by his parents to Lutheranism in 1938, thinking that would solve their problems with the Nazis. P.S. It didn't. So, but apparently the parents and he decided they were going to stay Christian. They came here, and Peter Berger, the former Jew, found himself in the Reali High School in Haifa, and persecuted by all the Jewish kids in class because he's a Meshumin. So he ended up going to school in the one of the Christian schools in Haifa, and it was until the end of his life he didn't admit that he really was born Jewish. But he wrote some profoundly wonderful books about how religion works, and one of them, which I very, again strongly recommend, is called The Sacred Canopy. And he says that every religious society, and he was a very spiritual person, every religious society not only has its rules, but it also has the canopy that envelops those rules, the atmosphere, the intuitive moments of sensitivity and spirituality and religious awareness and moral awareness, which infuse life with meaning and which find expression, or should find expression, in I'm not translating the Jewish terms, should find expression in the way we do, we were Kaivitzis, whether it had been at Adam Lachavero, but Adam Lachavero. So in the question of what should I aim for, the question is what kind of sacred canopy do you want to have is going to be the question. Sometimes it's very subjective. Sometimes there are things which are common between Haredi and modern and the Zionist worlds. It really requires a lot of very careful thoughts, a lot of homework, personal homework that comes with this. And you have to know that if you do one thing, you give something else up. You give up something else. If you decide to spend time, on having art, teaching art, then you're going to have less time to study Zemiros and Jewish poetry. I mean, that's going to be the trade-off. And is that good? Is that bad? And what do I want at what stage of my life? And what do we want the kids at what stage? And should I open them up better later? I mean, I'll give you an example. It's given out that the reason, it's not true, but the reason, the traditional reason why Volozhin was closed was because the Nitziv didn't want to include secular studies, according to Russian Tsarist mandate, in the yeshiva. I was finding that odd, because if you read the Nitziv says very clearly in his many places, in Parish of Chumash, which is actually his ideological manifesto, he says that the menorah symbolizes the seven wisdoms, which is symbolizing of all the best of what Matthew Arms, the best of what he's thought and said. The menorah symbolizes that? And he says that the fire of the menorah symbolizes pilpul. In other words, the interaction of Torah and the Sheva Chochmot together creates pilpul and enlightens and warms the world, and the light doesn't come from the outside into the base of Mikdash, the light comes from the outside inside out. So how can we close the yeshiva? Because they didn't want a secular studies. The answer is the atmosphere of the yeshiva and what a yeshiva or an open or a midrashah, whatever, gives to the student can't be adulterated. You want to learn the Sheva Chochmot, you should do that elsewhere after you already have your integrated worldview, which will then interact with the outside world. But these are all very serious questions of religious policy, religious policy is often dismissed. It's religious policy, not halacha. Halacha can become a avodah zarah too, guys. If it's not, I quote, I once asked the Rav about the Jewish catalog and the Jewish renewal movement then. And the Rav said it's a very dangerous book. I never heard him say a book of things. What's dangerous? He says, because it turns Judaism into ceremonials. And ceremonialism is pagan. What do you mean? If an action does not reflect and is not rooted in God awareness, if it doesn't have moral and spiritual and intellectual integrity, then it becomes a form of ceremonial. Which means that mitzvahs can also come in the form of avodah zarah. They have to be part of a avodah zarah. Say, I live a halachic lifestyle. I don't believe in God, and I think about it. That's kosher style. That's kosher style. Agadah has got to live together with halacha. What Agadah does is to provide the content and the orientation and the relationship of Kodesh Baruch Hu, which finds expression in halacha. Yeah, the Torah, the halacha has its own dynamic, as the Rav said. But it has a content as well. There's a professor in, I won't say where, in the United States who says, I am a halachic Jew. I know some believe in God, and I think the BDS, and I think that the Jew, and I think that all kinds of other stuff, but I'm a halachic Jew. The two have got to go together. Strikingly, people like to quote the Rav as Isha Halach, as halachic man. What they are not aware of the fact is the fact that from 1951 at least, don't listen to the tapes, his major theme, cocked at week after week, I heard it for 10 years in Boston, and I know from the fact it was before that, is guys, halacha is not enough.
What?
It's not enough. Halacha is a means of avodas Hashem, and you have to develop your spiritual personality. You have to encounter God. Yes, Talmud Torah is the most intellectual thing you will end up doing. Okay? It's also a profoundly spiritual encounter with God. And if the two don't go together, we have a serious, serious, serious problem.
I think it's a great place to end the formal talk.
Okay.
That was really wonderful. I think we should have another round of applause. Thank you. Thank you very much. Can we stick around? Little note, so the next event, we're actually trying to, as a group, do lectures, but also do things that are a little more out in the field, a little things that are a little more unique. So